Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Last week, we began a two-part conversation about innovation in Boston. Specifically, we focused on Boston's 400 years of innovation history, like the smallpox vaccine.
Anisimus was questioned by Cotton Mather in the beginning of a smallpox epidemic that happened in Boston in 1721. Boston at the time was the largest city in the largest town in North America and the third largest port in the British Empire. We're at the center of a lot of things.
That was author Bob Krim on the show last week, walking us through the origins of the smallpox vaccine in Boston. Today, we're going to turn our attention from the history to the present and the future of Boston's innovation economy. And to help us do that, we have Scott Kirstner. He's a columnist for the Boston Globe and author of the new book, I'm looking at it right here, Innovation Economy, True Stories of Startups, Flameouts, and Inventing the Future in New England. Scott, welcome back to Radio Boston.
It's really fun to be here. Thanks.
It's great to have you. So we covered a lot of ground with 400 years of history last week. I want to start now with the present, and then we'll go to the future. I'm thinking, if we talk about innovation in the pandemic year, what would Boston's culture of innovation have produced? Let's start with Moderna. We're seeing an incredible success story play out with them right now. Wasn't always the case, even pretty recently. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Moderna is such an interesting example because before COVID reached North America and started spreading beyond China, I think there were a lot of Moderna skeptics in the Boston biotech ecosystem. And it was a company that had raised hundreds of millions of dollars. It hadn't, early on, it hadn't published a lot in scientific journals about how this messenger RNA technology might work as a drug or as a vaccine. It went public and it was, I would describe it as, you know, a lot of people said Moderna is all hat and no cattle as a company. And up until the COVID vaccine got emergency use authorization in December, you know, they had no products that they sold at all. This was really a company that was doing research and development and not any sales. And then holy cow, I mean, the mRNA technology that they had been testing against some rare diseases like Zika and it as potentially a cancer therapeutic, they decided last January of 2020, that they should pursue it as a vaccine for COVID. And now it's being injected into millions of people's arms. And I like to call it sort of, it's an innovation land speed record. I mean, nobody thought that you could develop a vaccine and get it to patients that quickly.
So I want to go back, and I loved all the cow references. Holy cow, all hat, no cattle. You know, you said they had hundreds of millions of dollars, but also people thought they were all hat and no cattle. Square that circle for me, especially because it turned out they had a lot of cattle.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think there's this idea, you know, in the biotech ecosystem, there's this idea of a platform company and flagship pioneering is one of the venture capital company creation firms that's in Kendall Square. That's where Moderna was born as a project to say, hey, there's this thing called messenger RNA. We think we could use it as a drug or a vaccine. Let's run some experiments and see if there's potential there. They sort of call that a platform technology because the idea is, well, hey, we're not just developing one drug that's going to treat Alzheimer's disease, say. We're developing a platform that could be used for lots of diseases and lots of viruses. And sometimes those companies are seen as really spreading themselves too thin. You know, they're running lots of clinical trials. They're chasing lots of potential disease areas that platform technology could be used against. And Moderna was kind of in that state. But it turned out that they had a lot of work that was, I think, funded by the NIH and some work done in Europe against viruses. And they were just kind of at the right point of their maturation as a company.
Got it.
When COVID came along.
So, you know, that made me think a little bit about another another group, iRobot, with CEO Colin Engel. You had done a webcast on it recently. You talked with him about how when he started the company more than 30 years ago, he couldn't have predicted where it would end up either, which was not only a titan in the world of robots, but specifically, and who knew, right, robot vacuums. So how common is this, where you sort of start with a platform, you're working with robots, or you're working with, I can't even, in biotech, but you explained it, and you wind up with this specific, unexpected success somewhere?
Well, I think iRobot is a great example of the kind of company that Boston can produce. Boston Dynamics, also the other robotics company that's building these walking dog and humanoid robots, would be another one. And if you think about what's foundational about Boston, is we have these great universities that attract smart students and smart professors from all over the world. They really want to work at the edge of their field. They want to build prototypes. They want to publish scientific papers that discover new things. And a lot of university towns, that's where it stops. But in Boston, you have the funding, you have the venture capital money and the maybe wealthy individuals that will put money into a startup company. You have a lot of government grant funding. Both iRobot and Boston Dynamics got a lot of money from the Pentagon to run experiments about how these robots might help soldiers. And so there's this, you know, there's the smart people running experiments, there's the money to turn it into startup companies, and then there's occasionally experienced executives and entrepreneurs floating around that you can plug into those companies and really help them grow and find customers for their products.
So there are two things that I want to pull out of that. So first, I hear you, and yet we constantly get told the story, we don't have a Google here. You know, they didn't start here. Apple didn't start here. Facebook left here. You know, the conditions are more ripe elsewhere. Talk about that.
Well, I feel like I've been guilty at perpetuating some of those stories, because it is true that you've had entrepreneurs like Zuckerberg of Facebook, or Drew Houston and his co-founder at Dropbox, who go west and build their companies there. But I think that I've lived in Silicon Valley, and I've lived here much longer. Silicon Valley is about that commercial success. It is about getting rich. It is about making your other entrepreneur friends jealous at how much, you know, value you've created in the stock market. Boston just loves the discovery, and I think loves getting there first, and doesn't have that gene that says, okay, we got there first, and now we are going to wring every last dollar out of it and turn this into a global colossus. Now that said, like we used to say that Boston didn't understand how to do consumer-oriented companies. You can't really say that anymore. We have companies like TripAdvisor, we have companies like Wayfair, we have companies like DraftKings that have gotten pretty big, and they're national, or they're even international, and they're selling stuff to consumers. So I do think we're closing that gap a little bit, but I think that our fundamental DNA is just different DNA than you have in Silicon Valley.
So the other thing I want to pick up is, you know, what we've talked about over the years is a pretty gaping equity hole in Boston's innovation economy. And one of the characteristics of this pandemic is that it has set in relief in so many ways the fundamental inequities in our economy, our public health system, our education system. Put the innovation economy's experience during the pandemic in that context for us.
There was, if you worked in the innovation economy and you were at a startup company or a growing tech or biotech or sustainable energy company last year, you wouldn't have known that there was a pandemic on, except for the fact that you were having a lot of Zoom meetings and you were working at home. Venture capital funding set a record in Massachusetts in 2020. And so companies, I would talk to recruiters who were trying to hire software developers or trying to hire chemists. It was just as hard to hire those people in the midst of the pandemic in 2020 as it was a year before, pre-pandemic. So this is a part of Boston that, you know, you're right, it hasn't stumbled, it hasn't fallen in a pit because of the pandemic. And yet, you know, we're trying to solve this problem of, there are so many people who live in Boston who can't get these jobs, who are starting different kinds of small businesses and different kinds of new ventures that the venture capitalists don't put money into. And so there is a divide. It isn't quite the divide of the Charles River of Boston from Cambridge the way that it used to be. I think a lot of the innovation economy has crept into Boston, but there are definitely people who are non participants. And one of the people that I write about in the book, and you got me thinking about this, is Dean Kamen, the inventor who's up in Manchester, New Hampshire. He started this amazing nonprofit called FIRST that's all about getting kids in middle school and high school excited about math and engineering and science through these robotics competitions. We need 10 more organizations like that that are going to kind of create the pipeline of the next generation of company founders, of company builders and employees that are more diverse.
And Scott, are you seeing the level of reckoning and coming to the table to make massive changes like we're seeing around public health, around police reform, for example, other social issues laid bare by the events of the last 12 to 14 months?
I think a little bit. I don't want to overstate it or oversell it, because I think these conversations were happening, obviously, around the Black Lives Matter movement last summer. I think some of the conversations are happening at venture capital firms around, gee, we don't seem to have any women at the table who are helping us make these investment decisions. I feel like it would have been more intense, to be honest, in 2020 if people were together in offices face to face, right? It's hard to have some of these deep conversations and make real change happen when everybody is a postage stamp little square on the Zoom meeting screen.
Yeah.
But I do hope that this is something that is going to be gaining momentum. And I've been trying to write pieces in 2021 that look at, hey, who are the participants who are driving this economy today and getting rich from it today? And how do we really broaden that circle?
Let's continue this turn from the present to the future. You wrote a column headlined simply, "Will COVID Kill Cities?" Kind of seems like an important question. So I'm going to ask you, what do you think now? Will it?
I think COVID is a real body blow for cities like Boston and New York and San Francisco, and it's going to be felt most by people who own commercial real estate and people who own small businesses. You know, the dry cleaners, the sort of postage package store in the neighborhood, the tailoring shop, those kinds of things. I just don't think that people are going to flow back into downtown Boston or Cambridge in the same numbers as they were before the pandemic. And most individual workers would say, that's great. I'm happy to be in the office one day a week, 2 days a week, 3 days a week. But it's going to lead to cities, I think, that for a while feel really underpopulated and that are going to have to kind of equalize and figure out, hey, we have fewer people downtown. I kind of believe the people who still want to be in cities are those who really love the exchange of ideas that happens, you know, at a coffee shop in Kendall Square or in the Leather District in Boston. And they want to be having meetings where they're interacting with random people who happen to pass by the coffee shop table. But there were a lot of people that used to work in cities and they didn't like the commute. They didn't like sitting at a desk, and maybe they would rather be at home. So I feel like, the activity level and the vibrancy is really going to be hurting for the next couple of years.
Okay, last question. This is lightning round in like less than a sentence. What do you think is the next big innovation?
I think the next big innovation is going to be robots everywhere doing a lot of repetitive tasks.
There you
that
go.
Short enough for
wonderful.
You?
That was yeah, that was enough? Such okay. A great lightning round. Oh, you are good. That is Boston Globe columnist Scott Kirsner, author of the new book, Innovation Economy, True Stories of Startups, Flameouts, and Inventing the Future in New England. Scott, really fun to talk to you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Tiziana.